When you think about a disaster, a major accident, maybe a massive public health emergency, or just, you know, a situation where resources are completely overwhelmed, your immediate image is probably chaos.
Oh, absolutely. People reacting, engines, lights flashing everywhere.
Right. But beneath all that sort of desperate movement, there's often a complex, almost invisible organizational structure. Something working to impose order.
Well, it's like the ultimate lesson in management science, but under extreme duress. When everything is spinning out of control, the natural human tendency is just to react, isn't it? Instinctively.
Yeah, jump in and fix what's right in front of you.
Exactly. But these standardized systems we're going to talk about, they're designed to actually force efficiency and coordination, regardless of how big or complex the incident is.
Which feels counterintuitive and chaos.
Yeah,
it really does. So today we're diving into two essential layers here. The National Incident Management System, NIMS, which is the nationwide template.
Okay, the big picture.
Right. And the Incident Command System, ICS. That's the specific, flexible framework that actually runs the effort on the ground.
So that's our mission for this deep dive. Really understand the blueprint for tackling chaos.
Right.
Let's start with NIMS then. The big picture, the standards that ensure, say, a local firefighter in Oregon and a federal agent down in Florida.
They speak the same emergency language.
Exactly.
NIMS provides that consistent foundation. It's really what allows agencies that maybe never even trained together to suddenly integrate pretty much seamlessly during a crisis.
Okay.
Our sources highlight three core principles that make NIMS work. First off, flexibility. It has to scale, you know, from a minor three-car accident all the way up to, say, a Category 5 hurricane response.
Makes sense. It can't be one size fits all. And second,
standardization.
Ah, yes. Mm. This is essential because, like you said, everyone has to speak the same language. Yeah. We can't have one group calling for a triage kit and another asking for casualty sorting supplies.
Right. The definitions, the processes, even the forms are standardized. It cuts down confusion.
Okay. Flexibility, standardization, and the third.
And finally, interoperability. This is really the key that unlocks joint operations.
So?
Well, it ensures that fire, police, EMS, public health officials, local government, everyone can actually share resources and communicate effectively. Without that, you just have silos.
Got it. And these principles are supported by core pillars.
Yeah, things like resource management, command and coordination, and communications and information management, they're the building blocks.
So that's NIMS, kind of the philosophy and the overall template. Mm-hmm. But when the first truck rolls up to a major incident, let's imagine that train derailment you mentioned, maybe hundreds of passengers.
Right.
The actual structure that takes over is the Incident Command System, ICS.
Yes. ICS is like the organizational chart brought to life right there on the scene. And the absolute most critical first step, something that has to happen immediately upon arrival, is establishing command.
One person in charge.
One person.
Yeah.
The incident commander, or IC.
And here's that rule you mentioned, the one that really separates effective emergency managers. It says so much about the whole system.
It does.
The incident commander is strictly forbidden from getting distracted with patient treatment or other tactical tasks.
This is the massive counterintuitive challenge of command, psychologically speaking. Think about it. You're standing there. You might be seeing injured people right in front of you.
Your instinct is to help.
Exactly. But your absolute duty is to not help them directly. Your job is pure management. You oversee the entire incident. You set the objectives. Establish the priorities, develop the whole response plan.
So if the IC bends down to treat just one patient,
the whole structure potentially fails. Mm-hmm. Because that central point of coordination, the person seeing the whole board, is gone. They're lost in the weeds.
It's focusing on the macro problem, not the micro emergency right next to you. So the incident commander is kind of the CEO of the disaster scene.
That's a good way to put it, exactly. And their duties scale with the incident size. So if our train derailment is contained entirely within, say, one city's jurisdiction.
And then it's simpler.
Relatively. We use a single command system. One agency has the clear majority of responsibility. But let's say that derailment involves a chemical release and it crosses a county line or even a state line.
Now it's complicated.
Right. We immediately transition to a unified command system. Multiple organizations, multiple jurisdictions, they have to share command responsibilities. It ensures all the legal and logistical needs are met across those boundaries.
And because this is a formal management structure, there's a cycle to it, right? Command isn't static.
Correct. Command needs to be transferred smoothly if, say, a more senior officer arrives. That's usually guided by standard operating procedures, SOPs. And eventually, when the operation winds down, the whole thing is shut down formally via specific termination and demobilization procedures.
Okay, that flow makes sense. It brings us to the operational reality of ICS. Below the IC, there's that organizational spine you mentioned, the general staff.
Yes, the general staff. This structure exists to make sure that even in the absolute highest stress environment, no vital task gets overlooked. It divides the core responsibilities.
All right, let's break down this general staff. Four essential sections, the engine of the response. First up, operations.
Operations is the execution team. Simple as that. They manage the tactical operations, the actual work being done on the ground.
Like rescue, firefighting.
Exactly. Rescue, fire suppression, initial patient movement. If you're physically doing the task out there, you generally report up through operations.
Okay, boots on the ground. Then you have planning. Now, this sounds maybe a bit administrative, but our sources say this is really the strategic brain. What does planning actually do?
Planning is all about foresight. While operations is dealing with the immediate crisis, planning is thinking, you know, 3, 6, 12 hours down the line.
Predicting problems.
Predicting problems, solving them before they happen. What happens when the sun goes down? Where are we going to put the media staging area? They work closely with everyone else to develop the Incident Action Plan, the IAP.
The IAP, that sounds important.
It's the single source of truth for that operational period. It outlines the current status, the objectives for the next shift, say, and the specific assignments for every single unit. Without a clear IAP, coordination just dissolves.
Got it. Next section, logistics. I imagine this is maybe the most visceral need on a disaster scene.
Right.
You can't fight a fire without water or treat patients without bandages.
Absolutely. Logistics is the supply chain backbone. They're responsible for pretty much everything essential to keep the operation running. Setting up facilities, providing communications equipment, making sure there's food and water for the responders.
Fuel, medical supplies.
Fuel for vehicles, and critically, all the medical supplies needed for potentially mass treatment. They basically ensure the workers can keep working.
Makes sense. And finally, the one maybe people forget about in the heat of the moment, finance. Why is tracking money and paperwork so critical during an immediate emergency?
Well, because eventually someone has to pay for all this. Disaster relief efforts often need to be reimbursed, maybe by state or federal agencies, and accountability has to be absolute.
Right.
So the finance section documents all those reimbursable expenses. They usually have specific units, like a time unit tracking who worked how many hours, a procurement unit handling emergency contracts for supplies, and a compensation and claims unit. They make sure after the dust settles, the costs are tracked and allocated properly.
Okay, so the general staff operations, planning, logistics, finance, runs the engine. Now, around the incident commander, you also mentioned an immediate advisory group, the command staff.
Yes, the command staff. They don't report through those four main sections. They report directly to the IC. They're the IC's immediate sort of bubble of specialized advice.
Who's in that bubble?
Typically, three key roles. First, the safety officer. Their singular job is monitoring for hazards. Anything that could hurt responders or patients, unstable structures, hazardous materials, even just responder fatigue.
Crucial role.
Absolutely. Then you have the public information officer, the PIO. This is the only person authorized to give information to the public and the media.
Controlling the message.
Exactly. It's crucial for managing public perception, preventing panic, and ensuring accurate information gets out, not rumors.
Okay. Safety, PIO, and the third.
The liaison officer, or LNO.
Liaison. What's their function?
The LNO is the primary contact for external agencies. They relay information between command and any assisting or cooperating agencies that aren't directly part of the ICS structure, maybe the Red Cross or utility companies or agencies from other jurisdictions. They make sure communication doesn't break down when outside help arrives or is needed.
Wow. Okay. That structural overview is pretty rigorous. It paints a clear picture. So let's pivot now to applying this specifically to a mass casualty incident, an MCI. That scenario where local resources are just swamped, right?
Correct.
And mutual aid is definitely needed.
Correct. The definition of an MCI is essentially when your routine resources are overwhelmed.
So back to our train derailment example. The incident commander arrives. Mm-hmm. What's their very first action?
Scene size up. It's an instant analysis, really, built around two incredibly simple but vital questions. What do I have? And what do I need?
What do I have? What do I need?
Yeah. That initial assessment establishes the scope of the problem, the immediate resources required, and helps set the initial objectives, like how many patients are we looking at, what kind of injuries, what hazards are present.
And the IC also needs to figure out the nature of the incident itself. Is it an open incident or a closed
Yeah.
incident? What's the difference there?
An open incident is, frankly, terrifying because the full scope isn't known yet. The number of casualties might still be growing. Responders might need to search through debris or unstable areas to find patients. And the incident itself might still be ongoing. Think of a wildfire moving towards a town or an active shooter situation.
Okay, so uncertainty is high.
Very high. A closed incident, on the other hand, is somewhat more manageable, though still critical. The number of patients is generally fixed, contained. The focus shifts entirely to triaging the known patients and getting them treated and transported. Think of a contained building collapse after the immediate danger has passed.
Got it. Open versus closed. Now, regardless of which type it is, there's this absolute rule about patient movement that seems to reinforce that whole resource management priority we talked about.
Yes, the rule is never initiate transport of patients if there are unattended patients remaining on the scene.
Never. Why is that rule so incredibly important?
It comes down to accountability and maintaining control over your limited resources. If you load one or two injured people into an ambulance and send it off to the hospital,
that ambulance and its crew are gone for potentially an hour or more.
Exactly. And if you still have 50, 100, maybe more unattended patients waiting for assessment and triage back at the scene, you've just severely degraded your ability to manage the overall situation. You have to maintain control over those transport resources until every patient is accounted for, triaged, and has a designated transport plan within the system.
It forces a systematic approach, not just grabbing the nearest victim.
Precisely.
And managing all these people, all these moving parts, requires flawless communication. Our sources really emphasize using face-to-face communication whenever possible.
It's always the most reliable, less prone to misunderstanding.
But if you have to use radios, there's another strict rule. Do not use codes or signals. Use plain English.
Yes. In these high-stakes, multi-agency incidents, clarity is absolutely paramount. 10 codes, signal codes. They just introduce ambiguity. Someone from a different agency might not know your specific codes. It slows down decision-making.
Especially under stress.
Especially under stress. Every communication system used has to be reliable, has to be durable, field-tested preferably, and you absolutely must have backup systems in place. Miscommunication in an MCI can literally cost lives.
Which brings us squarely to the central operational challenge on the ground. Triage. Making those incredibly difficult decisions, sorting patients by the severity of their conditions.
Right. It's prioritization under pressure. And it generally happens in two phases. Primary triage, which is done rapidly right there at the scene where patients are found.
And secondary triage.
That happens later, usually within the designated treatment area, where patients might be reassessed more thoroughly.
Okay, let's focus on primary triage first. The goal there is speed, right?
Speed and simplicity, not definitive diagnosis. The most common system you'll see is START. That stands for Simple Triage and Rapid Treatment.
Simple and rapid. What does it assess?
It's designed to be incredibly fast, maybe 30 seconds per patient, focusing on just four simple things. Can the patient walk? Are they breathing? What's their circulation like? Checking capillary refill or pulse. And what's their mental status? Can they follow simple commands?
Four quick checks. That determines their initial priority.
Exactly. Red, yellow, green, or black tag. Immediate, delayed, minor, or deceased expectant.
And because kids are different physiologically.
Right. There's a modified version called Jumpstart Triage. It's specifically for children, usually defined as under 8 years old or appearing to weigh less than about 100 pounds. It adjusts some of the respiratory parameters, for instance.
Okay, START and Jumpstart. Are there others?
Yes. Newer systems are emerging too, like SALT Triage.
SALT? What does that stand for?
Sort, assess, life-saving interventions, and treatment and/or transport.
Life-saving interventions. That sounds different from START.
It is. That's the key philosophical distinction. While START focuses almost purely on sorting patients quickly, SALT explicitly allows for very limited, immediate, life-saving interventions right there during the primary triage process.
Like what?
Things like applying a tourniquet to control massive hemorrhage, or maybe opening an airway with a basic maneuver. Things that take seconds but could be immediately life-saving before the patient is even fully categorized and moved. It's a subtle but potentially crucial shift in protocol.
That is a fascinating evolution in thinking. And we're seeing technology evolving too, particularly with triage tags. These used to be just, you know, weatherproof, color-coded pieces of paper or plastic.
Right, maybe with some checkboxes.
What's the insight behind modern triage tags? What's changing?
It's really about moving from potentially unreliable paper tracking to real-time, high-stakes accountability. Modern tags often incorporate things like digital photos of the patient, unique barcodes.
Barcodes, like at the supermarket checkout.
Sort of, yeah. This allows the transportation unit leader, who we'll talk about, to scan the tag. They can track every single patient electronically from the moment they're tagged at the scene, through the treatment area, onto an ambulance, and all the way to their final destination hospital.
Wow. So you know precisely who is where, when they left, and what their condition was at that point.
Exactly. It massively improves patient tracking and prevents people from getting lost in the system, which unfortunately used to happen in very large incidents.
That's a huge leap. Now, we also have to consider the human element of managing this chaos on scene. What about challenging situations, like, say, a hysterical or disruptive patient who isn't seriously injured but is causing problems?
Yeah, that can definitely happen. Our sources suggest one strategy is actually utilizing the walking wounded, the green tag, minimally injured patients. If they're able, sometimes they can help comfort or manage others. It turns them into a resource rather than just another liability demanding attention.
Interesting. Using the situation to your advantage. Yeah, and you also have to plan for other special cases, right?
Absolutely. Things like what happens if rescuers themselves become injured, or the huge complexities of hazardous materials or even weapons of mass destruction are involved, requiring decontamination zones and specialized PPE before anyone can even start triage or treatment.
Okay. So once primary triage is done and patients are categorized, they move into a treatment area managed by the medical group supervisor and their team. Let's talk about the specific unit leaders under that supervisor.
Right. Within that medical branch or group, you typically have four vital leaders reporting up. First, the triage unit leader. They essentially oversee the primary triage process, make sure everyone gets tagged correctly, keep a count, and communicate those numbers up.
Making sure that initial sort happens effectively.
Correct. Then you have the treatment unit leader. This person is responsible for setting up the actual treatment area, usually organized by triage category, like an immediate red area, a delayed yellow area, etc. They oversee the secondary triage that happens there, ensure patients get appropriate care based on their category, and importantly, they communicate resource needs, like specific medical supplies, back to logistics.
So they run the field hospital, essentially.
In a way, yes. A very basic, temporary one. Then perhaps the most critical person for accountability in getting people out is the transportation unit leader.
Their job isn't just calling for ambulances, is it? I imagine it's more complex.
Oh, far more complex. They are the central tracking mechanism for patient movement off scene. They coordinate patient distribution, trying to send patients to the most appropriate receiving hospitals, preventing any single hospital from being overwhelmed if possible. But their primary function, enabled by those modern tags maybe, is meticulously tracking and recording every piece of information. Which specific ambulance or vehicle took which patient by tag number or name, what time they left, and their specific hospital destination. This ensures no patient just disappears into the ether.
Total accountability. Where do they get their vehicles from?
They coordinate with the staging area manager. This person sets up and manages the designated location, usually away from the immediate scene, where all incoming ambulances, fire trucks, buses, etc., park and wait. The staging manager releases vehicles and crews only when requested by command or the transportation unit leader. It prevents scene congestion.
Controlled flow of resources. Okay. And when it comes to deciding which patient goes where and when the destination decision is not first come, first served, right?
Yeah.
There's a strategy based on the triage tags.
Absolutely. There's a strict strategic transport process. It generally follows the triage categories, but also considers factors like physiology, the specific anatomy of the injury, the mechanism of injury, and any special considerations like age or underlying health conditions to pick the best hospital.
So how does that usually play out?
Typically, immediate red patients, those with life-threatening conditions, are transported first, usually just one or maybe two at a time in an ambulance, or by air ambulance if needed and available.
Top priority up first.
Right. Then the delayed yellow patients, those seriously injured but who can wait a bit, usually go next, perhaps two or three at a time per ambulance to maximize resource use.
Okay.
The walking wounded, green, those with minor injuries, might be transported later, often in larger groups using buses or vans if available, to free up ambulances for the more critical. Slightly injured might even be last.
And the expectant patients.
Yeah.
The black tagged.
Protocol usually dictates that expectant patients, those deemed unlikely to survive given the available resources and the number of other salvageable patients, are made comfortable but generally treated only once all other urgent patients have been transported off the scene. It's a terribly difficult reality of MCI resource allocation.
A brutal calculation based on saving the most lives possible with limited means. Finally, let's turn to the aftermath. We've talked about the operational preparedness, having written disaster plans in every vehicle, maybe personal go bags ready, constant training to make these procedures almost instinctive.
Drills, exercises, yeah.
But what about the psychological aftermath? For the responders who've managed that kind of intense, sustained chaos and made those life and death decisions.
This is perhaps the most fundamentally human aspect of incident management, and historically maybe the most neglected. Our sources consistently and sadly note the documented increase in things like PTSD, depression, anxiety, and even suicide rates among emergency workers, firefighters, police, EMS, dispatchers.
The burden is immense.
It is. The system must account for this human cost. That's why critical incident stress management, or CMSM, is so essential. It shouldn't be an afterthought. It needs to be part of the plan.
So CSM sounds like a structured way to deal with the psychological chaos after the physical chaos is resolved.
That's a good way to put it. CSM provides formal and informal support structures, debriefings, peer support, access to mental health professionals. These services should be readily available to everyone involved in the incident response. Importantly, participation is usually voluntary, confidential.
But it needs to be offered.
Absolutely. And crucially, the psychological impact on responders, the human toll, needs to be acknowledged and ideally documented in a post-incident evaluation, the after-action review. You have to look not only at what worked logistically and operationally, but also what the human cost was for the people who ran the incident.
Right, that after-action review. The final step, where you document all the successes, but maybe more importantly, the failures and challenges of the response, so you can continuously improve the system for next time.
Exactly, because ultimately, these systems, NIMS and ICS, they're built to impose order, to force resource management, and clear accountability over raw instinct. The complexity we've discussed, it's all driven by that necessity of moving beyond just treating the patient in front of you to strategically managing resources and movement across potentially vast systems under almost unimaginable pressure.
We've spent this deep dive detailing this really rigorous structure, NIMS and ICS, required to manage the physical and logistical chaos of an MCI. And we've seen how this entire framework really hinges on the incident commander maintaining that laser focus on pure command, on coordination. We talk about how critical that non-intervention rule is. Don't treat patients.
But here's something to think about. What happens when that critical coordination task breaks down? Not because equipment fails or supplies run out, but because of that leader's very natural, very human impulse to jump in and help the nearest injured person. Or maybe they just weren't trained well enough or mentally prepared enough to overcome that powerful primal urge in the moment. The system, ultimately, is only as strong as the human being holding that command clipboard, making those tough calls. That feels like the ultimate test of emergency management.